Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. Please be seated.
Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Ortiz. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Please the court, Chief Judge Efron, members of the court, always a pleasure to be back before the court. I'm looking forward to seeing you again in just a couple of short weeks at our outreach argument. Members of the court, in the case of United States versus Ortiz, the military judge erred by denying the appellant a public trial and by failing to articulate her reasons for doing so on the record. As such, the appellant's conviction must be reversed. Now, members of the court, this court's history and the history of the Supreme Court makes the rationale for a public trial quite clear, and that is to, of course, affect a fair result and to encourage truth-telling. In the instant case, the military judge failed to follow this court's mandates in United States versus Hershey and in ABC versus Powell, and failed to follow the clear instruction of the 2002 manual for courts martial, which was in effect at the time of the appellant's trial. And in the 2002 manual specifically states that a hearing may be closed over the objection of the accused only when expressly authorized by another provision of this manual. And the only provisions of the manual that deal with, in 2002, that deal with the closing of a trial are MRE 412, 505, and 506, none of which are applicable in the instant case. Now, the facts in this case are really fairly straightforward as it relates to the closing of the courtroom. And I would like to emphasize four of those facts for the court prior to proceeding into the argument. The first one is that there's clearly, this is a horrible way of putting it, but it's clearly unclear as to how many spectators were in attendance at the time. But what we do know is that on the record at page 61, the military judge, having a discussion with the alleged victim in this case, Bita Pagan, says, the courtroom is full of a lot of strangers. So we know, we have reason to believe at least, that there were a significant number of people in attendance. We also know, and again, it's unclear exactly how this took place on the record, but we know from the record at page 64 that the alleged victim, Ms. Pagan, testified with her back to the gallery. Unfortunately, it doesn't appear like the military judge did a very good job of sort of putting on the record, or the trial counsel did not, putting on the record of exactly how that went. But we know that she testified in some mechanism with her back to the gallery. We also know, and again, unfortunately, not very well expanded upon on the record, that at some point the trial counsel filed a motion in this case to have the alleged victim separated from the accused in some way during her testimony, and this is on the record at page 65.
Are you in agreement, or I don't know who you're agreeing with, the four-part press enterprise Hershey test, is that what we're applying here? Or
yes, I'm going to get that in just 2 seconds.
And you're going to state with specificity which of the elements of that test the military judge failed to apply?
And which one she sort of came close to complying with. Yes, Your Honor. And finally, we know that the questions elicited by the military judge in her inquiry under the Hershey test, which is listed on pages 68 through 69, were not terribly helpful and allowing this court to do an evaluation of whether or not there was a hearing as mandated by U.S. v. Hershey. On the record on page 68, the alleged victim says, well, somebody's here, and that sort of led to her discomfort in testifying, and somebody she's clearly alluding to appears to be the accused. On the record at page 69, the alleged victim says, it's not because adults are here and I'm not nervous. On the record at page 70, the military judge finally says, would it be a little easier if people were not here? And would you be able to answer the questions if people were not here? At first, the alleged victim nods her head affirmatively and then finally says yes. At this point, the court is cleared and the doors are locked. Judge, getting back to your questions, Judge Baker, with regards to the Hershey factors. This court in United States versus Hershey and in the Supreme Court in Free Press delineates a four-prong test in order to ascertain whether or not the court should be closed. And again, this is not necessarily the same test that was in effect in the 2002 manual, but Hershey was based on the 2002 manual, so it is the test that this court should apply. One is the government must demonstrate, and it's interesting in the Hershey opinion, this court actually either underlines or italicizes the word demonstrate, a compelling need to exclude the general public. And the reason for that is quite clear. It's because, as in Hershey, what this court does not want is to have sometimes trial counsel simply state on the record that we have a compelling reason. This court wants the trial counsel and wants the government to demonstrate a compelling reason. Clearly, this was not done here. As in Hershey, the trial counsel made assertions as to what would be the desired outcome if the alleged victim, if the courtroom were cleared, and that the alleged victim would be able to testify more clearly. And the military judge acquiesced after asking three basically leading questions to the alleged victim and getting her to nod her head affirmatively and then to answer in the affirmative. The appellant would argue that the military judge should have gone a number of steps further. There was certainly no evidence taken from anybody. There was no demonstration, there was no hearing, there was no evidence taken from anybody to articulate a specific reason as to why it might be easier for this alleged victim to testify if the courtroom were clear, to override the appellant's interest in a public trial and the public's interest in a public trial. There was no testimony from social workers, no testimony from her family, no testimony from anybody as to why the courtroom should be cleared, absent the three questions on the record at page 70, basically saying, would it be easier for you?
Counsel,
Ma'am. In
your brief, you give some examples of the testimony that the witness was giving in response to questions by government counsel, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you say that this sort of frustrating questioning went on for approximately 200 pages?
Both before and after the court were closed, yes.
Okay. How long, do you know how long in terms of time or number of pages it went on before the courtroom was closed?
I do not know the answer to that, Your Honor. I can check out on the break and see whether or not it's articulated by the timing of the two Article 39A sessions. We can certainly check on that and let you know.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. The trial counsel's stated reason for closing the courtroom is exactly what Hershey says is not the permissible grounds. Hershey states very clearly that you can't eliminate mortification of witnesses. In other words, for any witness at a court-martial, and certainly for a young victim, it's going to be difficult to testify. As according to Hershey, that alone is not sufficient grounds to close the courtroom. The only thing that Ms. Pagan said is that it would be, quote, easier if no one was there.
Let me ask you this. Are you familiar with the Bell versus Jarvis case from the
Fourth
Circuit?
Yes, Your Honor. The government sided. Yes, Your Honor.
And in that case, one of the issues is what to do in the absence of detailed findings of fact.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the court, the majority of the court said that notwithstanding the absence of the detailed findings of fact, viewed in conjunction with the known circumstances of the case and the record as developed, they provide a sufficient basis for reviewing courts to assess the propriety of the closure. So they said, we will look past the particular factors. We won't deal with each of them as dispositive, but we'll look to the record to see if we can nonetheless make the judgment ourselves.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why isn't that this case where we have a lengthy record and there's both a legal and a factual question there?
Well, there is, Your Honor.
The legal question is, why should we not apply the same kind of approach that the Fourth Circuit did, which is to say, okay, there are no detailed findings of fact, or as you're arguing, no clearly stated statement regarding the overriding interest, but we might nonetheless infer it or read it from the record. That's a legal question, and then if you can do that, why doesn't that lead to a particular result in this case?
I think it doesn't for several reasons, Your Honor. One, according to the 2002 manual, and a standard in the military, I would argue, for an open trial is even greater than it is in civilian courts. I would also argue,
What do you base that on?
Well, because I think that there's this general knowledge of how civilian courts work. I think that there is a general lack of knowledge as to how military courts work. And we would argue that the need for public scrutiny and public exposure, for lack of a better term, to a military court would even raise that bar just a little bit higher.
Is that a constitutional argument or a policy argument?
It's a policy argument. I would also argue that one has to look, Judge Baker, at the stature of the Bell v. Jarvis case, which is it was an ineffective assistance of counsel claim on collateral attack. And so the standard that the appellant in that case had to meet was significantly different than the standard that the appellant has to meet in this case. But finally, Your Honor, I would argue simply that the record in this case is not sufficiently developed as compared to the record in Bell. In Bell, we at least knew who some of the people were that were being excluded. There was talk about his wife being excluded, and then the appellant specifically not wanting her to come back into the courtroom. In the instant case, the record not even developed to the point of we don't even know how many people were in attendance.
Does it matter?
Well, I think it would certainly be helpful to this court to be able to ascertain, you know, because you look at the Hershey case, and Hershey said, well, there were only two people in attendance, the bailiff and the escort. So, therefore, the at least in spirit, the requirements for an open trial were met. In the instant case, all we know is the military judge's comment that says there's a room full of strangers. We don't know who any of those people
which
are.
Which
is rather ambiguous. And I think the concern from the appellant
in both ways.
Yes, Your Honor.
You know, the average court-martial is not heavily attended.
Is not heavily attended. I hope that mine are, but they're not generally.
Mm-hmm.
Counsel, you're focusing on the question of who was or was not present. In terms of Bell v. Jarvis, if we apply the general concept of that case here, that is, in the absence of findings, look at the record, what is there in the record in Bell v. Jarvis that would justify, with respect to the specific witness, the conclusion that the court reached there? And how would you distinguish that from this case in terms of if there is the absence of those factors here?
Well, I think certainly, Your Honor, one of those is the fact, as I said, that we knew at least one of the people that was not in attendance.
No, I'm talking, to make clear, I'm talking about from the perspective of the person who whose testimony was at issue for purposes of closing.
Okay.
Is there anything in the record in Bell v. Jarvis that would distinguish it from this case or this case from Bell v. Jarvis in terms of what that record established about the witness's difficulty in testifying that we would have or not have present in this case?
Certainly in that case, Your Honor, there had been a number of according to the opinion of the court, there had been a number of pretrial conferences involving the alleged victims in that case, which were several, and in which the very graphic nature of the testimony was certainly much more played out than it had been before the military judge in this case. The decision in this case was made after only 70 pages worth of testimony, and in which nothing really had been discussed. It was very cursory, very preliminary information provided by the alleged victim. It appears that all the military judge had in this case, quite frankly, was a charge sheet. Whereas in the Bell v. Jarvis case, there had been preliminary hearings, and the trial judge in that case had a fairly significant record on which to base his or her decision to close the courtroom.
But don't we have, putting aside the page number, but you said that we only have 70 pages, but it's 70 pages of non-responsive answers and ums and not looking away and looking away. I'm not suggesting a particular interpretation, but this is a witness on the stand who's clearly struggling with something.
She's clearly struggling.
You would agree
with
that?
I would agree with that.
So this isn't 70 pages of fluff.
About 45.
This
pages
is 70 of pages of something happening that is affecting the witness.
It is clearly about 40 to 50 pages after the preliminary 39 days of something happening that is affecting the witness. What that is unfortunately not very well developed in the record, which actually brings to the second prong of the Hershey test, which is that the closure has to be somewhat narrowly tailored. In addition, the fourth prong, which is that there must be adequate findings placed in the record. In this case, none of the alternatives to full closure were ever even discussed in the record, such as as in Bell v. Jarvis, closing the courtroom to certain personnel or using some form.
Didn't she try a bunch of not less restrictive alternatives, like comfort breaks, like turning the witness around, like letting the victim coordinator sit with her, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Isn't all that on the record?
Those three or four things are on the record. Yes.
Well, how many less restrictive alternatives do you have to try?
Bell v. Jarvis talks about that. It talks about possibly excluding certain members of the public. It talks about the possibilities of closed-circuit television. In fact, there was this motion filed by the government that was apparently withdrawn. In addition, members of the court, the military judge's own statement on the record at page 62 shows that she applied the wrong standard, in which she says, and I'm paraphrasing somewhat, the question seems to be whether she would be more capable if the gallery were excluded, more capable of testifying. Unfortunately, that's not the standard of Hershey.
Before we leave your point about the closed circuit television, that of course raises a different question, and that would be confrontation rights.
At that point.
And what type of record do we need to have before us to assess whether that is in fact a less restrictive alternative? in this case, or to ask the question a different way, and I don't mean to ask it rhetorically, but I haven't figured out another way to ask it. Why shouldn't we view that as, in the absence of any suggestion from the defense, as potentially a more restrictive alternative?
Okay, for a couple of reasons, Your Honor. One, if you're asking about less specific request by the defense, I think Hershey makes fairly clear that the defense doesn't need to do that. That's really the court's burden.
I understand that.
But to answer your question specifically, Your Honor, in any hearing, think of a suppression motion hearing by analogy, the court takes evidence. They don't just take a proffer by the trial counsel and three questions by one of the witnesses. The court takes evidence. Evidence would be a hearing with social workers, with somebody, to say, a psychologist, we see a lot in the Maryland v. Craig arena, in which a psychologist says, face-to-face confrontation with this accused is going to cause the alleged victim trauma. And in fact, I would say that that is particularly true in a case like this where it's a bench trial.
No, I understand that. And I understand your argument that in the absence of this record, we don't know whether the problem was face-to-face confrontation with the accused or whether the problem was something dealing with the spectre behaviors in the courtroom. My question is, from the point of view of a less restrictive alternative, strictly looking at that narrow aspect of it, why should we assume that for a defense counsel and for the defendant, closure of the courtroom is less preferable than confrontation?
Okay, my time's up, Your Honor.
Please,
answer your question before you sit down. Your Honor, I would think that it would be incumbent upon the military judge to do a couple of things at that point. To say, okay, defense counsel, you have objected to the closing of the court. Please put your reasons on the record. And then for her to state on the record, I have considered your reasons for closing. I've considered the four factors in Hershey, and here is my ruling. In the alternative, as the third prong of Hershey, I have looked at alternative methods of less restrictive methods than closing the court.
But that's not the chief judge's question. That's not his question. He's asking you, why would it be the case that a defense counsel would think that Maryland versus Craig, closed circuit television, would be a less restrictive alternative to temporary closure of the courtroom?
Well, I would think, Your Honor,
I think that's
your question, Chief Judge?
That's in the ballpark. Go ahead and answer that one. It's helpful.
Chief Judge, we don't answer your question or the chief.
No, that's I think they're both in the same ballpark.
Okay.
And that is, how do we know, or whose responsibility is it for us, placing on the record for us on appeal, to know whether that the judge should have considered the closed circuit TV as a less restrictive alternative when it may well be that the more difficult problem for the defense in these cases is a lack of confrontation rather than having people in the courtroom.
Well, I would think, I was trying to answer. I actually understood your question, Judge. I was trying to answer it. Apparently didn't do as good of a job articulating it. I think it's incumbent upon the military judge to say one of the tests in Hershey is this third prong test of using less alternative, and then to proffer to the defense. Give me a proffer of what you would do or what is preferable to the defense in the alternative in this case. But I think it's incumbent upon the military judge, not upon the defense, because the only question before the defense at that point was clearing the courtroom. The question of closed circuit TV or something like that was not before the defense, and then we can deal with it once the record is developed, which unfortunately was not in this case.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Court.
Counsel for the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I am Captain Trevor Nelson, and along with Colonel John Miller II, we represent the government as appellee in this case. Appellant's right to a public trial in the Sixth Amendment is not absolute. And this is the kind of case which required a military judge, after considering appellant's right to a public trial, balance against the government interest of protecting a young, vulnerable witness, to prescribe reasonable alternatives in the interest of fair administration of justice. The Supreme Court established a four-part test in Press Enterprise that outlined the circumstances under which a judge can determine a courtroom to be closed. And that is overriding interest, that it's narrowly tailored, that the reasonable alternatives were considered, and that there's an adequate factual basis. This court also said and U.S. v. Hershey, adopting the Supreme Court test in First Enterprise, that particularly in sex cases involving minors, that a military judge must also consider the age of the witness, the psychological maturity and understanding of the witness, the nature of the crime, the desire of the witness, as well as desires of family members and relatives.
Counselors, I understand the defense counsel's response to my last question. It offers the following proposition. That is that the record seems to indicate, in the defense counsel's view, that the problem that this witness had was with the presence of the accused in the courtroom. And so we have two rights at stake, the right to a public trial, right of confrontation. And the defense perspective is that it's the responsibility of the military judge to then develop a record as to what the underlying problem is and what the basis is for taking action. And that in this case, it may well be that faced with the two choices, the defense would have preferred to forego confrontation rather than forego the public trial, and that the record doesn't provide a basis for us determining which one was the less restrictive alternative. What would be your response to that?
Your Honor, under the Press Enterprise and the Hershey test, the military judge must consider reasonable alternatives. She does not have to consider all alternatives, and the government would argue that remote life testimony that is allowed under MRE 611 would be even more restrictive than closing the courtroom to the public. Because there you remove the witness from the presence of the accused. So we would argue that's even more restrictive than what the military judge did here after considering, as just Stuki mentioned, several steps the judge takes, like allowing the victim witness liaison to sit close to the witness, allowing for leading questions, providing a comfort break, and then ultimately having the witness turn her back towards the gallery and face the military judge.
But how do we know that this defendant, in this case, would have found the closed-circuit TV to be more restrictive than having the public present? That is there any basis in law for determining that one is a higher value than the other that we would then impose on the defendant without having it placed on the record?
You know, I think they're of equal importance. I don't think there is any basis in law that says one is more important than the other. However, here, the appellant did not ask for remote life testimony. They certainly could have requested it. And there's no requirement that a military judge goes through an exhaustive list of what the alternatives were, or the sui sponte suggests that remote life testimony is a viable option. Could she have? Yes. What is she required to do? No.
Counsel, what was the overriding interest of the military judge in closing the trial?
Your Honor, here, the overriding interest is to protect the minor victim. Now, this is a victim who, and a social worker testified on page 371 of the record, that she suffered from PTSD. She was only 9 years old when she was raped and sodomized by the appellant over a 10-month period of time.
What did the military judge say her overriding interest was?
Your Honor, the military judge did not articulate an overriding interest. But this witness testified for, to answer Judge Ryan's question earlier, for over an hour and a half on the record, which covered approximately 53 pages. The military judge was in a position to observe the distress and embarrassment of the witness.
Well, what do you do with the fourth prong of the Hershey test that requires that the military judge make adequate findings that we can know what she was thinking?
Your Honor, in this case, you have to look at what the specific facts and circumstances are. The military judge here did not make specific findings, that's correct. But this court, even if there are not specific findings as in the case of Hershey, or the case that we cited from the Fourth Circuit, Bell v. Jarvis, this court under its de novo review powers can still look at the entire record and make a determination that appellant here was not denied his public trial right.
But we can't find facts and we can't somehow speculate or determine what the military judge was thinking when she closed it.
No, Your Honor, we can't speculate about what the military judge was thinking, but we have facts in the record. The military judge, you know, this was a partial closure. It was not a blanket closure as in the case of U.S. v. Rubin, where this court found that it was violative of appellant Sixth Amendment right to a public trial.
Well, when you say partial closure, wasn't the majority of her substantive testimony, the victim's substantive testimony, which was the crux of the government case, all of that was closed? Is that correct?
The majority of her testimony was closed, Your Honor.
Okay, right. And was that not the crucial testimony for the government in obtaining its conviction?
That was certainly a crucial testimony for the government, Your Honor. But under the press enterprise of Hershey standard, there's no allowance made for what type of testimony with respect to whether it's crucial or not so crucial. Once the four-part test of Hershey is met, then military judge is within our discretion to close the court, whether it's for only a part of the testimony or all of the testimony. In this case, you had 10 witnesses testify in total, 6 on the merits, and the closure was only with respect to the victim here for about one-third of her testimony, two-thirds of her testimony.
I noticed in your brief you argue that the overriding interest was the prosecution of appellant's heinous crime against this 9-year-old victim. In response to my question, you said the overwhelming interest or the overriding interest was the protection of the witness.
Yes,
is that the same way of saying, or two different ways of saying the same thing?
Those are both compelling interests from the government standpoint, Your Honor. But primarily, it's the protection of the victim and to ensure that there's no, the harm of the victim is not somehow aggravated or that she has an ability to effectively communicate in court, as well, of course, the government interest in prosecuting these kind of crimes against minors. The military judge...
Follow up on Judge Erdman. The military judge is supposed to make adequate findings. You've conceded she made no findings, at least no explicit findings. So it's up to us to tease it out of the record?
No, Your Honor, because it's readily apparent in the record. The testimony of the victim went off for...
It's up to us to take it out of the record.
It's up to this court. This court has a point and an overview to look at the entire record.
What constitutes adequate findings for appellate review in something like this? No findings? Is the government saying basically that no explicit findings is adequate findings for appellate review on these facts?
With respect to these facts, Your Honor, correct. We're not making a blanket statement that in every case...
No, I'm not asking for a blanket statement.
Right, but with respect
but you're saying that a basically total lack of explicit findings constitutes adequate findings for appellate review on these facts.
On these facts, Your Honor, correct.
You.
And that's because we have a witness here who testified for over an hour and a half on the record, as the government made a good faith effort to solicit testimony in open court. And the military judge, of course, being able to, and this was Judge Alone trial, military judge here being able to observe the witness, notice her embarrassment and discomfort, and make a determination ultimately. So this was narrowly a tailored. Here, we didn't have a blanket exclusion of all witnesses being sequestered in a closed court. It was only one witness, and partially. Now, with respect to
counsel, that to go back to your response to Judge Erdman on that point, if we were to conclude that the judge erred, does the number of witnesses and the quality of the testimony then go to the question of prejudice?
Your Honor, because it involved the Sixth Amendment right to a public trial. If this court prejudice is presumed, this would be structural error.
So that in the government's view, that if there is partial closure for one witness whose testimony is duplicative, that terminates the whole trial on appeal. The whole trial is invalidated.
Your Honor, I didn't quite understand.
No, do you never test for prejudice? What if the closure involves one witness whose testimony is duplicative of other witnesses' testimony? Would that be structural error that would invalidate the entire trial?
Your Honor, it's going to depend on what the facts and the circumstances are in each and every case. In this case, The prosecute. This is the vital testimony that came from the prosecutors.
Well, counsel, in at least as I read Hershey, they find that there was an error there in closing the courtroom for the one witness, and then they go on to find that there's no prejudice because it was a partial closure for one witness, even though it was a key witness for the government. So I'm not sure what test you're talking about.
Can we start over? I don't know what question you've answered and what your answer is.
Your Honor, with respect to the question of prejudice is presumed. Appellant here would not have to allege specific prejudice with respect to his public trial rights. Back to Judge Ryan Person, with respect to the Hershey case, even if this court finds that the military judge abused their discretion by not making specific findings, this court could still look at what the actual facts and circumstances are and make a determination on the record that appellant public trial rights were still not violated.
Well, I mean, isn't the question under Hershey whether he was denied his right to a public trial or whether there was a partial closure of the courtroom for some part of the trial? I mean, isn't that a distinction that makes a difference?
Your Honor, in Hershey, it was whether he was denied a public trial right. Now, the court found there that the spectators that were barred were performing government function, and as a result, it did not amount to a barring for public. In this case, we don't know who exactly was
in the gallery. You might want to consult with your supervisor as to what Hershey actually said. Or not. I mean, I can read it myself, but I don't think that you understand what it says. I don't say that to be mean. I say it because you're representing the United States government, and the argument that you're making isn't based on the case, at least as I read it.
We could come back with a subsequent site with respect to Hershey. However, the government position is that the test that was followed in Hershey was the same as was in it was adopted from Press Enterprise with respect to structural error. If there's a wholesale barring of the public from the courtroom, and in Hershey it was somewhat different because we had witnesses there that were performing or spectators that were performing a government function. And in this case, it's unclear from the record who was exactly in the courtroom. Nevertheless, the victim, as she testified to the military judge on page 67 of the record, she talked about the adults that were in the courtroom. Her problem was not, or issue was not with a specific section of the court or the appellant individually, but she referenced all members. As a result,
can I ask the frame the question a different way? In the government's view, and I'll ask this at the, or hope the appellant answers the same question during rebuttal time. Is it the government's position that failure to apply the four-part Press Enterprise test is tantamount to a violation of the Sixth Amendment right to a public trial? Are they one and the same?
They're not, Your Honor. Because if the military, looking at the abuse of discretion standard with respect to the military judge making a determination as to closing the courtroom, this court still has under this de novo review power under the Sixth Amendment, with respect to the Sixth Amendment, to look at the entire record and makes its own determination.
Is it the government's position that on these facts, a violation of the Sixth Amendment right to a public trial is not made out, but if it is, then the error is structural and you don't have to talk about prejudice.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's the government's position.
That is the government's position.
Okay.
Our position is that, first and foremost, there was not an abuse of discretion because the judge correctly applied the four-prong test.
I'm not interested in whether there's an abuse of discretion. I'm interested in whether there's a violation of the Sixth Amendment. And because you've said that once you go down that road, then it's structural and you don't have to test for prejudice.
If this court finds a military judge incorrectly applied with respect to the four-prong of Hershey, mm-hmm. then this court can look at the entire record and makes its own determination that an appellant was still not denied the Sixth Amendment right to a public trial.
Okay.
That's the government position.
Counsel, and I may have thrown you a bit off track in using the word prejudice there because Hershey does refer to it as structural error. Strikes me that may be a bit of an overstatement in Hershey, in that if it is a duplicative witness, it's not clear that it would necessarily be structural error to exclude all the spectators for that one witness.
And in this case, Your Honor, we didn't have duplicate witness here with respect to this portion of the testimony. The victim here was the first witness to testify. There was testimony later in open court that went over some of the same material that this witness testified to from the social worker and the forensic examiner. But with respect to this juncture of the trial, this was the first witness and this was the only testimony at this point with respect to the allegation of rape and sodomy. If there are no further questions, may I conclude?
Please.
This court should affirm appellant's conviction and sentence because the appellant received a public trial. The partial closure of the courtroom to project the dignity of a minor victim during her distraught testimony on how appellant raped and sodomized her when she could no longer testify in public was narrowly tailored and did not violate appellant's Sixth Amendment right to a public trial.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
But answers to some of the questions posed by the court. Your Honor, I'd like to start with you. You had asked for some specific times on the record, and I have those for you. The court was convened on record page 13 at 0934. Ms. Pagan took the stand on the record at page 27. There was no time because there was not a break prior to that. Record at page 49, she took a comfort break at 10:10. On the record at page 50, the comfort break ended at 10:24. Page 66, there was a recess at 10:42. Page 67, they reconvened at 10:54. Page 71, the court is clear. There was no time for that, but it's only four pages after the last recess. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes, thank you.
I think it was Judge Baker asked a question about Bell, or maybe the Chief Judge, with regards to what facts were on the record at Bell that were not on the fact here. I'll point the court's attention to the record at page 2, in which it says, that the trial judge noted that the testimony would be of an apparent nature, closed the court, the next day it was closed. At a minimum, however, the court reporter, court personnel, the jury, the prosecutor, Bell's attorney, and the family members and friends of the minor witnesses were allowed to remain. Finally, Judge Baker, I will turn to your question that you asked. Is the failure to apply the test, articulate the test on the record, tantamount to a denial in all cases? And the defense would concede that it is not. In the Hershey case, clearly, there were only, what Hershey talks about is the right to a public trial does not mean that you have to have a public trial. If nobody attends, the judge doesn't have to put on the record why there is nobody in attendance. But in a case such as this, where there clearly were people in attendance, and apparently a fairly significant number of people, then the appellant argues that the military judge has the responsibility, as articulated in Hershey, of putting her factual findings on the record. In this case, in fact, there was no discussion at all, Hershey talks about these, about whether or not it would cause the victim to testify or to have a lack of candor when she testified. The military judge doesn't put those findings on the record. The military judge doesn't put whether the alleged victim would be embarrassed, whether she was fearful. None of this information is put on the record. And the government counsel argues that the overriding interest is protection of the victim, and that there was evidence on the record that the alleged victim had post-traumatic stress disorder. I would point to the record that this testimony, I believe this is responsive also to Judge Efron, Chief Judge Efron's question, this testimony came place much later on in the record. At the time in this proceeding, when the record was closed, the military judge really had scant little information about the case as compared to the judge in the Bellevue Jarvis case. Finally, Judge Ryan, I'll take a stab at your question with regards to the specific test for prejudice. I believe that what Hershey requires is that you do not specifically test for prejudice. That's the language of Hershey. But what it then says, and I think this will go ahead and answer.
Sure. I was just going to say, would you agree with this point, which is that what Hershey does is it first asks the question, did the military judge err in not making specific findings on the record? And then having once answered that question, it says, you know, if there is a violation of the right to a public trial, then that is going to be prejudice per se or structural error.
Yes,
but it went on to say, ask the separate question, which is, in this case, was there in fact a violation of the right to a public trial? So it disaggregates the question of whether the rule was complied with whether the question of whether there was a denial of the right.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I don't believe that the question of whether or not there was a de facto closing of the courtroom is part of the prejudice test. Subject to any further questions from the members of the court, let's conclude the appellant's presentation.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted. The court will be in recess until 10 minutes before 10 o'clock this morning. Thank you.
Court stands in recess until 9:50.